This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 29th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up on today's show, a military coup sends the president of Honduras into exile. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court issues two big decisions, ruling in favor of white firefighters and state regulation of big banks. And Iranian paramilitaries conduct nighttime raids on dissidents' homes. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After hearing emotional testimony this morning from a scant few of the thousands of people bilked by Bernie Madoff, a judge sentenced the architect of the largest fraud in U.S. history to 150 years in prison. Spectators in the courtroom erupted in cheers when the sentence was read. Federal law requires an inmate to serve at least 80% of a sentence before becoming eligible for parole. The Ponzi scheme administered by Madoff robbed investors of as much as $65 billion. Argentina's ruling party was stunned by the results in this weekend's midterm elections. Marcos Federman reports from Buenos Aires.
Government supporters, mostly low-income citizens, were expecting to prevail in this weekend's midterm elections, but victory never came. The election results indicate a rising opposition shifting Argentina to the right, and possibly changing South America's political map when a new president is elected in Argentina in 2011. The government's party, the Frente Justicialista para la Victoria, lost every key district, weakening President Cristina Kirchner, who has strong ties to leftist governments throughout South America. Esteban is an activist who supports the Kirchner administration.
We are electing the country model, either redistribution of wealth or going back to the 90s and neoliberalism. Nationalizing public services such as water, mail, part of the train system, Argentine airlines, and retirement funds are positive things. We also have a fluid, brother-like relationship with the Venezuela of Hugo Chavez.
The clean elections strengthened democracy in Argentina, where on the same day voters went to the polls, the national government condemned a military coup taking place in Honduras. Marcos Federman, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Clashes between Shiite and Sunni Muslims continued today in the streets of Beirut. The violence erupted yesterday after Sunni leader Saad Hariri was appointed Lebanon's next prime minister. Don Duncan has the story.
What started as a heated armed conflict between Shiites and Sunnis in Beirut has begun to quiet down to a few roadblocks and burning tires in the city's Aisha Bakar neighborhood. But the army is still on high alert in what remains a volatile situation. The sectarian violence revolves around the contentious issue of veto power of the opposition in the new government headed by Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri. His Sunni-led coalition won a majority in Lebanon's elections earlier this month. The Shiite-led opposition gained a blocking veto power last year in a peace accord in Doha, Qatar. The agreement put an end to 3 days of street fighting between Shiites and Sunnis that brought Lebanon to the brink of civil war. Now Hariri says that veto was won under duress and is invalid. Removing the veto will severely weaken Shiites in the new government, and the events of this weekend and today show the Shiites are willing to fight to maintain it. Don Duncan, FSRN, Beirut.
In Afghanistan today, President Hamid Karzai said Afghan guards employed by U.S. forces killed a police chief, along with at least four others this morning. The governor of Kandahar said that the 41 private guards surrendered their weapons and were arrested. The U.S. military said it was not involved and called the attack an Afghan-on-Afghan incident. On Wednesday, the Department of Education will launch a program that makes it easier to repay federal college loans. The program includes a provision allowing loan payments to be put on hold for people making less than 150% of the national poverty level. Free Speech Radio News' Matt Pearson.
The Department of Education will launch the Income-Based Repayment Program on Wednesday. The program is intended to help graduates who may have trouble meeting basic life expenses such as food and rent while paying back expensive student loans. College grads whose loan repayments are high relative to their annual income and family size can have their monthly repayments cut to make them more affordable. After 25 years, remaining balances are forgiven. There is also a special provision in the program for graduates who are interested in careers in public service. Their remaining balances will be forgiven after 10 years. All college graduates with current loans that are not in default are eligible to apply. Information is available at the Department of Education's website, www.ed.gov. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
The Central American country of Honduras changed its president yesterday, not with elections, but through the use of force. On Sunday morning, President Manuel Zelaya was kidnapped and detained by the military, which put him on a plane to Costa Rica. President Zelaya was promoting a controversial referendum that was supposed to take place Sunday. The non-binding referendum would have asked Hondurans if another vote on a new constitutional assembly should be included in the country's November elections. Roberto Micheletti, who was president of the National Congress, was named interim president amidst international condemnation to the coup. Luz Ruiz reports.
Since the news of Zelaya's ouster, hundreds of Hondurans have rallied on the streets of Tegucigalpa, the country's capital, demanding Zelaya's return. International reactions against the coup were soon expressed by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez, Bolivia's President Evo Morales, and others in the region. In the U.S., President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called for a peaceful resolution. Interim President Roberto Micheletti ordered a 48-hour curfew while mobilizations throughout the country continue amid heavy military controls and a virtual transportation blockade. Martin Sanchez, a teacher in Tegucigalpa who is participating in a national strike, called against the coup.
We call on the Honduran people to come to the capital, and if they are not able to come here, to mobilize in their regions, to take over roads, bridges, factories, and everything they can, because we will not allow a de facto government. We will only recognize the leadership of Mel Zelaya, because he is the only one who has been elected by the Honduran people.
Detention orders have been issued against many Honduran social leaders and human rights activists, as well as the majority of Zelaya's administration. OFRAN is a Black Brotherhood organization in Honduras, composed of Garifuna people living in the Atlantic coast of Honduras. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, a member of OFRAN said those who supported the opinion polls are targets.
As a social movement, we are very worried because we have had a very firm position for the opinion poll. The Honduran people have a right to be consulted. We have made public declarations and have strongly pronounced our support for this right, and that is why this is happening.
The last military overthrow in Honduras was in 1963. Juan, who declined to give his last name due to security issues, is a member of the Honduran social movement. He explains the possible impacts of this coup for his country as well as for the region.
This is a repressive takeover of power. This is a coup against the Honduran people. And if this coup is consolidated, it will be a regression of 30 or 40 years for Honduran society. Mr. Micheletti, who is at the head of this coup, has declared that nothing has happened here. But the Honduran people in the international community know that there has been a coup, which seems to be being revived in the Latin American countries. We are at risk of returning to repression by the armed forces.
Last night, Zelaya was flown into Nicaragua to participate in a meeting with the leaders of Central American countries. Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has also called for an urgent meeting to discuss the situation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luz Ruiz.
The U.S. Supreme Court today ruled in a reverse discrimination case involving 20 firefighters, 19 white and one Latino, in New Haven, Connecticut. The ruling may have wide-ranging impacts on discrimination in employment law. The case might also help fuel conservatives' opposition to Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. As today's decision in Ritchie v. DiStefano ruled against an earlier ruling Sotomayor upheld as an appellate judge. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
In 2004, New Haven gave exams to firefighters for promotion to lieutenant and captain. No African Americans and only two Latinos who took the exams scored high enough to be promoted. So the city threw out the tests. And since then, no one has been promoted. The 20 firefighters sued, and their case wound through the district and appellate courts, which supported the city's position that the test results were discriminatory on their face. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed in a narrow 5-4 ruling. The 20 victorious firefighters, in their dress blues, walked proudly with their attorney, Karen Torre, to the steps of the federal building in downtown New Haven. Frank Ritchie, the lead plaintiff, addressed their supporters and the media.
I think that this is just proof positive that people should be treated as individuals and not statistics. And that won out at the Supreme Court today. And all 20 of these guys worked hard to study, to apply themselves at work, to read trade magazines, to take classes on their own time. They're all heroes, and they stood up not knowing where they were on these exams. We all took this position not knowing if we would be promoted. So I think it's phenomenal that everybody stepped forward and took this position because the exams were valid. And if you work hard, you can succeed in America.
A half hour later, Mayor John DeStefano held a press conference at City Hall. He said the city had serious concerns about the test results.
The city's focus was on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Title VII ensures equal employment opportunity for everyone, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, and religion. Further, Title VII protects against, and I quote, not only overt discrimination, but also practices that are fair in form, but discriminatory in operation.
DeStefano praised all the New Haven firefighters for continuing to do, quote, an exemplary job, while the lawsuit wound through the courts. The case now goes back to the federal district judge, Janet Arterton, but most analysts believe she has little recourse but to mandate the promotion of the New Haven 20. In her dissent, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg faulted the majority for not taking into account the context of the case, in which historically, in New Haven and around the U.S., fire departments have been filled disproportionately, if not exclusively, with whites. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
The Supreme Court also handed down a crucial decision on lending practices of national banks. In a rare coalition, conservative Justice Antonin Scalia sided with the four liberal justices on the court to uphold states' laws protecting against discriminatory lending practices. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
This case is about states' rights, civil rights, and consumer rights. In 2005, then-New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer wanted private information from Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and other national banks. He suspected they violated New York's fair lending laws by offering unreasonable loans to minorities. The banks refused to hand over the information, pointing to federal law as protection. But in a 5-4 decision with Justice Scalia writing the opinion, the court said state law must be followed. The majority of justices wrote that, quote, states have always enforced their laws against national banks. Consumer protection groups applaud the ruling. Mark Savage is a senior attorney at Consumers Union. He says New York State was prohibited from protecting consumers, but the Supreme Court has changed that.
We now have 50 more sheriffs on the beat trying to work to help consumers and prevent abusive banking practices.
But the banks say this ruling will force them to follow a patchwork of regulations. Gregory Taylor is Associate General Counsel and Vice President at the American Bankers Association.
Where the confusion and potential for confusion will come in here is the fact that you now have a dual regulator seeking to enforce those same laws.
Lauren Saunders is managing attorney at the National Consumers Law Center in Washington, D.C. She supports the Supreme Court's decision, but she also echoes the bankers' concerns about patchwork laws. She says Congress must work to increase federal regulation and strengthen states' abilities to enforce their own laws.
Congress needs to pass a new federal consumer protection agency to protect consumers. Right now, it's the federal banking agencies that are in charge of protecting consumers, and we've seen the abysmal job that they've done. And Congress also needs to amend this Civil War era statute and make sure that states, which are closer on the ground, who see abuses first, will have the ability in the first instance to act when they see abusive lending practices starting.
President Obama has proposed new regulations that would protect states' regulatory power. This Supreme Court decision could give Congress more impetus to pass new laws. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Today was also David Souter's last day as a Supreme Court justice. Souter was picked by President George Bush Sr. in 1990, and over the years he developed a reputation as a liberal justice. especially on environmental causes, including a 2007 decision which enabled the EPA to regulate carbon emissions. Legal analysts say that with Souter's retirement, environmental advocates have lost one of their best allies. Souter said he simply didn't like living and working in Washington, D.C. The confirmation hearings for Souter's replacement, Sonia Sotomayor, will begin in 2 weeks. Join us Friday, July 3rd for a special FSRN documentary.
If you can imagine the trauma that people went through, I think people are still living in a lot of traumatized experiences here in, you know, urban communities, you know, where you have shootouts and police violence, police brutality, a combination of that just keeps you there.
In 1980, as tens of thousands of refugees fled violence in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, President Jimmy Carter signed the Refugee Resettlement Act. He declared that the United States would finally take responsibility for the devastating effects of its policies in the region. Over two decades later, that promise remains unfulfilled.
This is our community center, this is our history. These are the faces of all the people that helped build this place. This is the history in which we come from. So that it always is an inspiration and reminder of who we are and what we're doing here. You know, what are we trying to do here in the Bronx?
FSRN profiles the struggle of Southeast Asian refugees in the Bronx, where a new generation is emerging as leaders in a community that's still facing the trauma of war and violence. That's Friday, July 3rd on Free Speech Radio News. Iran's Guardian Council confirmed the re-election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad today, after a partial recount of 10% of the votes. Opposition candidates refused to participate in the recount, with two of them describing it as a ploy. Protests over election results continued in Tehran's streets this weekend, although violence against protesters has discouraged large demonstrations. However, on Sunday, riot police clashed with some 3,000 demonstrators near a mosque in northern Tehran, dispersing the protesters with tear gas and batons. The security crackdown has made street demonstrations increasingly difficult to stage, and dissidents are now shouting slogans against the government from the rooftops of their homes. Human Rights Watch reports that this resulted in several nighttime raids against protesters' homes over the weekend. We're on the line now with Peter Bukart. He's the emergency director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us about these nighttime raids? Where are they happening and who's being attacked?
Yes, I think we have to look at the crackdown from the beginning. At first, the Iranian government attempted to stop the demonstrations on the street by mobilizing large numbers of security forces as well as this volunteer paramilitary force known as the Basijis, and they managed to stop these mass protests just by terrorizing people and literally beating them in the street. But after that, protests continued at night with people going onto their rooftops and shouting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great, and other slogans associated with the reformist movement to let the government know that the protest movement was still very much alive. And since last week, we've been receiving very credible reports and we've been talking to eyewitnesses who've told us how the security forces, the police, as well as these Basiji paramilitary groups have been going into entire neighborhoods, destroying cars in the streets whenever they hear people shouting from the rooftops, and also going into houses and apartment buildings and systematically going into homes and terrorizing people, destroying their furniture, and beating them up whenever they hear these kind of shouts from the rooftops.
Are people being arrested during the raids?
Yes, certainly arrests continue both during the day and the night, and there's two types of arrests taking place. First of all, a lot of reformist officials, politicians and strategists, as well as internet bloggers and journalists and anybody who plays a prominent role in this protest movement has been arrested, except for the top leadership itself, for the presidential candidates. But then underneath that, thousands of people literally have been arrested, including many demonstrators in the street and people at night during these nighttime raids.
According to the information you have, these raids are being conducted by paramilitary groups called Basijis. Who are these groups and what's their relation to the government?
The Basiji is a voluntary organization which was created very early on in the history of the Iranian Islamic Republic by Ayatollah Khomeini. And they are a volunteer force of people who are trained to basically assist the police with maintaining law and order and morality. As you probably know, Iran is ruled by a very strict Islamic system, which insists on a separation of the sexes in public, as well as a strict dress code for women. So the Basiji are typically the people who, in plain clothes, go around on the street and assist the police when women are inappropriately dressed or men and women are mingling inappropriately according to their interpretation of Islam. But they've also traditionally been used as kind of the shock troops. They've carried out many attacks at the universities very early on in these protests. And they're also the black-clad people you see in much of the amateur footage, which is emerging from Iran, beating up people and shooting from rooftops. So they are one of the least disciplined but most brutal parts of the kind of security apparatus in Iran.
Now, on the other side, there's people shouting slogans from their rooftops. What's the importance of this practice? Why is it so significant?
Well, the Iranian Islamic Republic came into existence 30 years ago after a similarly mass protest movement against the Shah of Iran, who also had very brutal security forces and prevented the mass mobilization of people on the street at times. And 30 years ago, people would also go to their rooftops and shout Allahu Akbar, which means God is great in Arabic and in Farsi. And they would also shout death to the dictator, namely the Shah. And this is the first time since that historical protest movement, which helped bring down the Shah, that people have resorted to this very symbolic strategy of protest.
That was Peter Bukart, the Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch. You can listen to the whole interview online at www.fsrn.org. Colombian President Álvaro Uribe is in Washington today to speak with President Obama. Uribe will be pushing for the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, and he'll be talking with U.S. leaders about U.S. military aid to Colombia and joint anti-narcotic programs. Peace activists responded to Uribe's visit with a demonstration outside the White House. Tanya Snyder reports.
Hundreds gathered in front of the White House as President Obama prepared to meet his Colombian counterpart for the first time. 10 chained themselves together, blocking a major intersection for hours and risking arrest. They want Obama to be tough with Uribe.
Obama, you have this opportunity. This is a time to chart a new path with Colombia.
Ben Beachy of the solidarity group Witness for Peace organized the demonstration.
A time to declare that the free trade agreement, that model is defunct. We're discarding it. We're talking about a new framework that has nothing to do with the old model.
As one of an ever-shrinking minority of conservative pro-U.S. leaders in Latin America, Uribe was President Bush's closest ally in the region. Despite his country's abysmal human rights record and a 40-year civil war, he's been unable to end. He's hoping to get to know Obama on this visit. He's advocating for the free trade agreement he negotiated with Bush, which Congress has so far refused to pass. As a candidate, President Obama indicated he was hesitant to sign the deal because of Colombia's human rights situation.
The history in Colombia right now is that labor leaders have been targeted for assassination on a fairly consistent basis, and there have not been prosecutions.
According to the International Trade Union Confederation, 49 unionists were killed in Colombia last year, more than all other countries put together. Beachy says Obama's right to be skeptical of the trade deal, not just because it could further marginalize workers, but because competition with U.S. crops could destroy Colombian farms.
If the free trade agreement passes, Colombian farmers will be displaced en masse. They will be facing three options at that point: migration to the cities or to other countries, production of coca, or affiliation with the armed actors. All three of those would be a disaster for Colombia. All three of those actually go against explicit U.S.-Colombia policy.
Uribe has been wildly popular with some sectors of Colombian society, as he's credited with decreasing violence. But not everyone feels safer. Marino Cordoba is an Afro-Colombian activist who was displaced from his home in the town of Rio Sucio after a massacre there in 1997. Death threats sent him into exile in the U.S. a few years later. He says it's still far too dangerous to go back.
While there's what we call a democracy under a dictatorship, human rights defenders can't speak out or demand justice in the country because we're murdered when we do. So there's no security for us in the country.
Uribe has been the target of several scandals over the last few years. U.S. government documents from before his presidency list Uribe as an important narco-trafficker dedicated to collaboration with the Medellin drug cartel at high government levels. More recently, dozens of lawmakers went to jail for cooperating with illegal paramilitary organizations known for their brutality. Investigations are spiraling ever closer to the president himself. And 27 members of the military were ousted last fall for their involvement in a controversial practice known as false positives, in which soldiers killed civilians and dressed them up as guerrilla fighters in order to inflate figures of combat deaths. And Uribe's administration was caught earlier this year wiretapping opposition politicians, Supreme Court judges, and journalists. Though the Colombian constitution only allows for two terms as president, Uribe is gunning for a third. Amanda Martin was a human rights advocate in Colombia for 3 years.
There's a lot of corruption in Colombia. The powers that be will do everything that they can in order to ensure that he has a third term. The popular voice of the people is very strong, and I do believe that they're gaining ground. There will be bloodshed, and hopefully the people will win this time.
A referendum to allow Uribe to run for a third term could be held sometime this year, though some Colombian lawmakers are getting cold feet over the idea. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Headlines editor Nell Abram, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Oscar Hernandez. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.